Hey friends, welcome to Worry Less, Wag More. This is the Behavior Bets podcast. I'm your host, Ferdy Yao. Join me to dive into the thrills and challenges of treating pet behavior issues. I'll shine a light on science-based training that's effective and brings us closer to understanding the animals we share our lives with. Okay, we are recording. Wonderful. Alrighty, so let me get to that bio here. Okay, here we go. We're going to get started. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on the Worry Less, Wag More show today. Today's show is really, really special to me because this speaks right to what my passion is, and I think for a lot of you out there as well. This is about helping our shelter animals. And my guest today is Dr. Sheila Segerson. And Dr. Segerson is the Director of Community Solutions for Maddie's Fund and a board-certified veterinary behaviorist with over 25 years of experience supporting animal welfare organizations in the United States. She started her career working in shelters in 1987 as a volunteer at the San Francisco SPCA. And now Dr. Segerson regularly speaks at shelter and veterinary conferences and has contributed to several online courses and textbooks. Now, Dr. Segerson has expertise in dog and cat behavior and behavior programs, including program structure and development, admissions, enrichment, behavioral assessment, decision-making, behavior modification, foster care, adoption, and safety net programs. Wow, you are truly a unicorn, a board-certified veterinary behaviorist, which is, that in itself is incredibly impressive. And then all this work that you're doing with shelters. Really want to dig into how you got to here.
Oh, thank you so much, Ferdy. I'm really excited to be here. And I think a lot of my background just shows that I'm kind of old because I've been around for a long time and always learning and learning and teaching at the same time. I love the work that I do.
Yes, and we're very lucky to have you. So let's just start off with Maddie's Fund. I think especially in the shelter world, a lot of people know Maddie's Fund and they know who they are. But the first thing that comes to most people's mind is basically grant money for shelters.
Yeah.
But probably a lot of them don't know about some of the educational offerings and other programs that Maddie's Fund does. So can you talk a little bit more about Maddie's Fund and its mission?
Yeah, I'd love to. So Maddie's Fund, we're actually celebrating our 30th anniversary this year in 2024. We're a family foundation established 20 years ago by Dave and Cheryl Duffield. They established us in honor of, they had a very, very special and feisty miniature schnauzer named Maddie, and they loved her so much. They said, if we ever become wealthy, we're going to give back to the animal welfare community what Maddie gave to us in love. And so that's a lot of love, because the foundation has awarded over $275 million since we were founded. And as you said, a lot of it is grant to shelters. We also have provided grants to shelter medicine programs in the United States. But we do have a big education and conversation. So we have educational offerings. Maddie's University is our free online platform where there's lots of free courses for many, many different topics related to animal shelters. And the more we learn, the more we want to learn. And the more we learn, that we're going to progress more by learning from everybody in our community. So conversation is very important to us. And to that fact, we have Maddie's Pet Forum, which is an online discussion forum that is free to use. And we have regular meetings every Monday, Maddie's Community Conversations, where we talk about things that are important to our communities as we're working to keep pets out of shelters and in homes.
So that's great. Yeah. In fact, I started following the forum discussions, and there are many different forum discussions, and I generally don't pay much attention to them because basically I don't really have all that much time. But for this one, I've been paying close attention to, and it's been really enjoyable just to get a sense of the community in Maddie's Fund here. So I really love that. Now, can I ask you, as Director of Community Solutions at Maddie's Fund, what is it that you do?
So I do a lot of different things. Our big focus at Maddie's Fund these days is community and keeping pets out of shelters and in homes and increasing the communication and support with our communities, and not just talking to the wealthy donors, but bringing everyone in so that they're a part of working and supporting animals. And so the foundation of what we do is all centered around that. But what I do on a day-to-day basis is really, I consult with shelters a lot these days. Probably about 60% of what I do is consulting with shelters and supporting them with regard to their behavior programs and risk assessment and outcome decision making. And I also do a lot of education. I host a monthly meeting about behavior, and we have another monthly meeting that's about behavior research that supports shelters, as well as working to review and create online courses for Maddie's University. So really most of what I do these days is consulting and education.
What kind of experiences did you have to help you prepare for this role? Because it obviously involves a lot of different skills.
Yeah. Experience I've had, I first started volunteering in shelters back in probably 1987, a very, very long time ago. I started volunteering at the San Francisco SPCA, and I'll never forget that I had purchased a purebred American Pitbull Terrier from a breeder, and then, because I didn't know anything about shelters at the time, and then I went and started volunteering at shelters and realized, wow, you can get these dogs for pretty much free if you just start spending time in shelters. And a lot of where I got to today is that is a really good example, because it's about getting involved and learning from the experiences that I've had and learning about what's going on and where I need to focus my efforts. I'm always really interested in learning from wherever I can. So besides academic learning and books and things like that, which we're all obsessed with, I also like looking at, so trauma is a topic that I'm really interested in. And I mm-hmm. enjoy attending human workshops, online workshops on trauma, to learn more about what's happening in the human realm. Because I feel like the more we learn from different from people who are doing the same thing but in different fields, the more we can develop solutions to help our animals. I don't know if that answers that question well enough.
I think that's a great answer. I think it covered a lot of all your experiences and what you needed to really work in a shelter, to really experience it, you know, and learning from those experiences. So you spoke about trauma. So I want to dive into developing behavior programs in shelters. But trauma is obviously something that unfortunately is a big part of the reality of working in shelters and helping animals in shelters. So can you speak to, we're gonna just focus on dogs, because otherwise we would be here forever talking about everything. But what are some signs of trauma in shelter dogs?
So when we're looking at shelter dogs, the signs of trauma are oftentimes just the regular things that we see. So aggressive behavior, barking, those types of things, jumping up, those can all be signs that they're not coping with the shelter environment very well and that it's a traumatic experience for them. So sometimes it can be challenging, especially because when we think about the definition of trauma, trauma is in the eye of the receiver. So something that's traumatic for me may not be traumatic for you. And the same goes for dogs. So some of the signs that we see of trauma can be really general and not specific. And therefore, it can make us uncertain. Is this dog behaving this way because that's who they are? Or are they behaving this way because of the traumatic experience? And some of the things that I really look for and make me more suspicious. Number one, I just pretty much assume that if you're a dog in the shelter, you have experienced trauma. You've been separated from your family. You're in an environment that's not a home and where you have very little choice. But the behaviors that I'm really looking at is when I have dogs who have unstable emotions, unpredictable behavior. So they seemed like a fairly stable dog, and now all of a sudden they started doing X, reacting to dogs who are walking by their kennel. So sudden changes in behavior that are unpredictable are big things I look for. Other things like hypervigilance, scanning the environment, and repetitive behaviors are other good ones. And then other just out of context behaviors are other big ones I look for when I'm evaluating trauma.
Okay. Yeah, I can see how that's really hard, because I think for some people, they may look at a dog and say, well, they're just not getting enough exercise and they're not getting enough mental stimulation. And to someone else, that could be the behaviors that they see could be that, this dog probably experienced some sort of trauma and are really struggling to deal with this environment. That takes a fine eye, I guess. Is that something that you learn through experience?
I think through experience, for sure. I worked with a shelter a couple years ago where they had wonderful enrichment programs for their dogs. Their dogs all got out several times a day. They had play groups for dogs. They had other types of enrichment for the dogs. So they really provided a lot for their dogs. And you weren't seeing some of those classic signs of trauma in terms of lots of dogs with repetitive behavior or severe reactivity. And for some of those dogs, it wasn't until I took them overnight for a sleepover that's where I saw the behaviors of hypervigilance and more reactivity. When I took them out of the environment that was not an ideal environment, but where they were comfortable, and moved them to something different, and that's where the signs really showed up. I wanted to comment on something else you said in terms of thinking the dog just needs more exercise, because that is oftentimes something we can do to assess whether the dog is experiencing trauma versus not. Is up what we're providing to them, up the care that we're providing for them? Are those signs going away? Are they developing resilience, or are those signs staying there or getting worse? And that's when the suspicion that the dog has had a traumatic experience gets higher.
Thank you. That's really helpful to understand. So let's talk about what are the challenges to developing behavior programs in shelters? What are some of the most common ones, or some that are not so common that you've experienced?
I feel like we could probably spend a whole week talking about challenges.
Oh my goodness, yes.
In shelters. I think the biggest challenge is something that we can't do anything about, and that is the fact that a shelter is not a home environment. And these dogs are coming into the shelter environment in need of support. That's why they've been surrendered. Someone can't take care of any of them anymore. They need support, and we're doing our best to provide that support. But it's really challenging, and I feel like there's no question but that we are strapped for resources. We don't have enough people resources. We don't have enough money, that kind of thing. I also feel like there is a lack of understanding of how much work there really is to do with regard to behavior. And an example of that, I have a behavior survey when I'm starting to work with a new organization that I have them fill out so that I can get a general idea of where they are with different programs. And so I look at things like the care they're providing in shelter, including things like enrichment and training, look at things like foster care and behavior support to their foster caregivers, community support. Are they working to keep pets out of the shelter, as well as supporting adopters and fosters, looking at how they're doing with education and training of their staff, risk assessment, overall program management. I can go on and on in terms of all the different pieces of work that we need to do as behavior professionals in the shelter environment. And oftentimes when our leaders are hiring someone to do behavior in the shelter, everybody wants to hire a behavior person, but we oftentimes don't think about how much there really is to do and how much, in my opinion, we need to focus on all those pieces of keeping the pets out of the shelter, foster care, preventing them coming in the first place, so that then we have a little more capacity to support, hopefully, a smaller number of pets that are with us, which right now we're very, very far away from because so many shelters are struggling.
Yeah, and that's certainly true. I know for one thing that in my area, this is New York, Westchester County, New York City area, kind of the suburbs of New York City. So the adoption rates are pretty much down across everywhere, across all shelters and rescues around here. And it's been, particularly this past year, it's been a real struggle for many, many shelters, many of us working in shelters. So this is why I want to keep talking to people like you and keep spreading the word and doing more education. But, you know, you touched on, like, how we need better understanding about behavior, finding a trainer or developing a behavior staff as part of a shelter can be more challenging than you think. Because I think there's a thought that these dogs in the shelters, all they need is training, that you can just train any problem out of the dog, so to speak. What would you say to that if someone said that to you? That they just need some training, they'll be fine. They just need some love and training, and they all turn out fine.
Yeah, I my response to that is training is wonderful. I'm never going to say don't work on training dogs because it certainly can be beneficial. But I need to say, the more I learn about behavior, the more I feel I don't know, because there is so much that we still need to learn. But a big thing that I've learned and focused on over the years is the importance of relationships. And so if I have a dog who comes to the shelter and has experienced trauma from being separated from family and all the other things, they're in a place of extreme uncertainty. And oftentimes when animals are experiencing that, the number one thing we can provide for them is a sense of safety and comfort. Because people and animals need to be able to feel safe, to be able to think of positive emotions and to have the foundations of good things happening. And so for me, training is great, but relationships and focus on safety is really key and foundational to me.
I totally agree with you. Can you dive into that a little deeper? And what is a sense of safety and comfort look like in terms of developing relationships with the shelter dogs?
So once again, just like trauma is in the eye of the animal experience, I think safety is also in the eyes of the animal experience in it. And I think that's a really, really important concept to think about, because I recently, 6 months ago, fostered a dog who had spent most of his life outdoors in a kennel environment. And when I first started fostering him, I wanted to welcome him to my home and spoil him and give him all the good things. But for him, safety was staying out in my backyard in the same igloo-type kennel he had in the place where he used to live, because that was all he knew. And so that's what I provided him with. I bought him an igloo kennel and let him live outside in my backyard. And over time, he became comfortable staying inside. And all he ever wanted to do after that was stay inside. So meeting them where they are, getting to know them to understand what safety is to them. There are some things that are pretty universal, I would say, in terms of safety. Things like avoiding things that are that will potentially cause more trauma, like punitive training techniques. We want to provide predictable routines and schedules and consistency with how we're interacting. I'd say those are probably the really big things for me with regard to safety.
That's a wonderful answer. You know, one thing that you spoke about before, want to follow up on this, the idea of being separated from your family and being surrendered to a shelter. What do we know about what kind of trauma that can cause?
I can't right now remember any specific research about separation from family and that demonstrates definitively that it's a stressful and traumatic experience for dogs. But I would say that my anecdotal experience over the past 25 years and if we've never experienced that, it's probably a good thing to see the trauma of separation. But we know there is a decent amount of research on attachment in dogs. And we know that if we think about attachment theory in humans and apply it to animals, Monique Udell has done a lot of research in this area. And we know that dogs have attachment styles and separation from those attachment can be extremely stressful for many, many dogs. So I take that back about research. I suppose that attachment research demonstrates that for us.
Great. Well, and what was that name again?
Monique Udell.
Monique Udell. Okay. Remind me to try to get some of that research paper links from you. So you spoke about a sense of safety and comfort for the shelter dogs or all shelter animals. What else is essential for successful behavior programming in a shelter?
So other things that I stay up late at night thinking about are things like getting to know the dog as an individual, because when I am trying to help a dog, I need to make sure that whatever that support I am providing is relevant to the dog. So the example that I gave with my foster dog who wanted to stay outside, that type of thing. And mm-hmm. Also with regard to training and interactions, making sure that what we're using as a reward is something that the dog actually enjoys. So relevancy and getting to know the dog as an individual so we can understand who they are and what they like and what they don't like is certainly super important. Other things that are important in terms of behavior programs is setting aside time to think and focus and plan what you want your behavior program to look like. I know that when I don't work in shelters anymore, I only do consulting, but when I did, I almost always was in reactive mode where you deal with what comes at you and what is there right in this moment. And one of the challenges is that if we're always working from a position of reactivity instead of being proactive and planning, we're never going to get to where we want to be in terms of having the programs that we want. So setting some time aside each week to focus on program development and really focusing on programs to keep the animals out of the shelter or get them out of the shelter. So preventing intake, providing behavior support before intake, and really supporting foster programs. And it can be really, really challenging when you don't have a behavior person or you're only one behavior person and you have lots of work to do. And that's why getting to know other trainers and behavior people in your community to develop connections, and so that we can outsource work. So you might not have the ability to provide counseling for someone who is trying to keep their pet and has a dog who's barking all the time, but you can connect people with trainers in the community who can provide that support. So developing those connections so that we're all working together to support our community is something that I always come back to as something that's important.
That's a great answer. What are you talked about getting to know the dog as an individual, and I know you don't work directly in shelters anymore, so but when you were, what was that process like for you?
So, and I don't work in shelters anymore, but I do visit shelters and spend time with them, and I still do foster. And the process is, for me, is really just spending time with them. I feel that early in my career, I was really interested in behavior assessment tests. This was a long time ago, and there was a hope that we were going to be able to have some type of behavior assessment test that was going to be predictive of future behavior in the home. We found out that that wasn't true, but in the process of studying behavior assessments, I learned that part of why it was very difficult to have an accurate test was the stressful shelter environment. Another part is that if you're trying to do a test in a standardized way, which if you want a valid test, it really should be standardized, then you're not interacting in a natural way necessarily. Because if I am, and this is all circling back to getting to know dogs, but if I'm getting to know a dog, I am observing that dog's behavior. And if that dog is showing signs of fear, I'm going to back off. And if I were doing a standardized behavior assessment test and that's not in the process, that's where we can sometimes get into problems with some tests if they're not adaptive. And so for me, getting to know them is assessing their behavior, not through a standardized test, getting to know them. If at all possible, I prefer to do that in a foster home. Most times that's not possible when I'm visiting the shelter. And a second best for me is getting to know them in an office space or an outdoor yard, somewhere where they have a little more freedom, somewhere where they have some choice, where I can start to learn a little bit about who they are and what their needs are.
Now, you talked about preventing intake. And part of that is providing behavior support before the animals are surrendered. And I've done a little bit of that myself here in New York City. And it's, I gotta tell you, it's such a fulfilling part of my work to know that, hey, I can help keep this animal out of a shelter and have them stay with the family. Can you describe, like, what are some typical, or I don't want to say typical, but what are some, you know, common behavior problems that people will surrender their animals for, and that could be a relatively easy fix, you know, if they met with a qualified professional trainer?
Yeah, I'd say that's a great question. I'd say one of the, sometimes the big ones that us behavior people don't really think of, but are really big to people who have pets in their homes, is barking. So common that people are getting nuisance complaints from neighbors for a dog who's barking during the day. And there's so much we can do to help people, to educate them about the cause, discuss with them about the causes of barking, whether it's boredom, whether they're alarm barking to something in the environment, and teach them ways to prevent that barking from happening. So barking, a big one. House training issues, another big one that obviously, if you're a renter like me, your landlord certainly doesn't want your dog or your cat peeing inappropriately in the home environment. And then I'd say the other big category would just be excitable, energetic dogs who need some structure in their lives and lots of things to do in their lives instead of whatever they want, which oftentimes gets them into trouble.
When you said that, the first thing that pops in my mind are those adolescent dogs that they're going through that teenage stage, and they're completely naughty, and they're not so cute as puppies anymore. And so all that behavior becomes less tolerable for people, and they're generally adult size now with the behavior of a naughty puppy or naughty teenager. Okay, so let's see. What are some easy things that shelters can do to either increase adoptions or improve the well-being of the animals in their care?
So in terms of, I'll start with increasing adoptions, and there are lots of different things that we can do there. I am very, very lucky that at Maddie's Fund, the person that I work most closely with is Kelly Dewar, and her focus is foster care and marketing. And so learning and using techniques, how to take good pictures, things like that, how to help people to get to know dogs in ways that help them to get them out the door. So that those pieces of things is in terms of helping people to get to know that true dog and who they are and what they're going to, and help them to imagine what that dog is going to be like in the home environment, can make a huge difference in terms of getting the animal out. So Kelly is really, really good with social media and connecting with potential adopters. And so much of this is building and getting to know our community, right? Because when we have dogs who are a little more challenging to find homes for, I think about the fact that, so sometimes I have a dog that maybe only 5 out of every 100 people are going to be a good match for that dog. Those 5 people are a wonderful match and they're going to love this dog like crazy, but it's 5 out of every 100. And when I have dogs like that are a little more challenging, I need a lot of people knowing about my shelter and coming into my shelter and getting to know our programs. So building volunteer programs, building community interaction, getting out into the community so that we can reach those people is such an important piece.
I want to ask you about, as a veterinary behaviorist, how can behavior medicine play a role in shelters? And what can and what can't it help with?
This is probably one of the topics I talk the most about these days. And I think it's really interesting how things have changed over the years, and that when I first started working in shelters as a veterinarian with a focus on behavior, this was before I was a veterinary behaviorist, we really didn't use behavior medication at all in shelters. And things have really changed. I think they've changed for a number of different reasons. One of them is that we are working harder to try to find homes for dogs. They're staying in shelters longer, not the healthiest environment. So that's certainly a situation where oftentimes we need to consider behavior medication. We've also learned a ton about stress and potential trauma. And if we're doing everything that we can to try to reduce traumatic experiences, oftentimes that does mean behavior medication. Yes, we do want to be providing enrichment. We do want them to have that human interaction and getting them out of their kennels. But we can, in many situations, we can be doing everything possible in terms of environment, and we still have stressed animals. And so behavior medication can really help us to reduce that fear, anxiety, stress, and frustration so that animals can cope a little better with the shelter environment. So it's something that is helping them while they are in that care, in our care, and then hopefully help us to get them out. I know some people are concerned about using behavior medication because they say, oh, I don't want to drug the dog. I don't want them to be not who they normally are. And I think it's really important to think about the fact that in most situations, they're not who they normally are in the shelter because they're being kept in this kennel, in this cage, and they're not being able to behave how they normally are. So we have them in this artificial environment, and expect them to be behaving the same way they did when they would be in a home environment. So because of all that, that's why behavior medication can really help. And our goal being that we are reducing that fear, anxiety, stress. If I'm seeing negative side effects, like a dog being drugged or heavily sedated, that's a sign that I haven't picked a good medication for this dog, or I need to change dosages.
Great. So is there anything that you think behavior medicine cannot help with in the shelter?
For sure. I'm trying to think of examples right now, which I may not be able to come up the best with. Well, so behavior medication, when we have an animal with a behavior challenge, it almost always has the potential to help somewhat. I'd say probably the situations where I have the most concern is when shelters have animals who are either not safe to place in a home environment or are of questionable safety in terms of whether it's safe to place them in a home environment. And using behavior medication in those situations, because those are situations where animals oftentimes end up being stuck in the system for years with some shelters because people aren't comfortable or adopting them because they've displayed dangerous behavior. So I'd say that's probably my biggest concern about behavior medication is when it's being used without thought to the big picture and what is our goal, what is our hope, what is going to happen with this dog.
Yes. Yeah. And safety is always going to be safety in my community is always going to be a top priority for me working in a shelter. I want people to come to my shelter thinking, hey, you can find some safe family pets here. You know, they might be rough around the edges, but, you know, I want them to think that, hey, you have a good chance of finding a safe dog that you can that can be a part of your life, your community, your family. So those are things I really, really prioritize. Now I want to ask you some more about stress, because you know we're talking about shelters. What are some patterns of stress that lead to vulnerability and sensitization rather than patterns of stress that lead to tolerance and resilience?
I love this question. A couple years ago, I read this, what I felt was this really interesting book. It's called What Happened to You, Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing by Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey. Have you heard about this book?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's a really good book that is a combination of science. So Bruce Perry primarily presents the science side of things, as well as stories to help us understand trauma and the impact of trauma on us. And then obviously me being an animal behavior person, I then try to extrapolate that to people. And in their book, they have a beautiful graphic that depicts how when the experiences we have are unpredictable, extreme, and prolonged, so when we don't know what's going to happen or it's happening for a really long time or it's super, super intense, those are situations where our systems can become more vulnerable or sensitized. So these are the situations where our unpredictable experiences can lead to unpredictable behavior on the dog's part and a sensitized trauma system. Whereas alternatively, theoretically, when experiences we have are predictable, they're mild to moderate, they're controllable, those are theoretically situations where we can build tolerance and resilience. But it's important to acknowledge that if I'm a dog, I come into the shelter environment with a serious trauma history, that environment might be predictable, moderate, and controllable, but I already have a sensitized system, so I'm still going to have what we might consider to be an unreasonable reaction. So those are probably general things to consider, but not rules always.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's very helpful. Now, I want to ask you about actually a specific dog. I want to ask, what would Dr. Segerson do here about a specific dog I have in the shelter right now? This is a young pit bull mix, you know, the pity mix. She's a female. She's about 2 years old. She's been in our shelter for a year now. And she, her main issue has been what I call it arousal biting. So what I mean is in moments of high arousal or frustration, and I'll give you some examples, she will jump and grab either you, your body part, or she'll grab the leash. And she'll clamp down hard. That hard enough to you know, bruise me through you know, a couple layers of clothing. You know, this occurs very frequently when I'm taking her out of the kennel, or we're on a walk and let's say I do not allow her to investigate something she's interested in, and either because it's something that's dangerous or she just can't do it right now, and she'll turn around and either grab at my feet or she'll jump up and grab at my arms. So I'd like to hear, what would Dr. Segerson do with a dog that is showing these types of behaviors?
I love this. So this dog is a pretty typical dog nowadays when we're talking about our more challenging dog in the shelter environment. I think many people listening to this will say, yep, I've got five of those right now in our shelter. And I love how you described this dog, because how you described her is the place where I start. Because arousal biting is not arousal biting is not arousal biting. We did some research back when I was at the Center for Shelter Dogs to evaluate a treatment plan for dogs that were excitable or jumpy, mouthy type dogs. And one of the things, we never published the research, but one of the things that I learned is that arousal is not arousal is not arousal. It is why is that arousal happening? And with this dog that you described, it sounds like her arousal is related to sometimes just excitement. She wants to get out. She wants to be out, and she doesn't have control of what she's able to do. And some of it is related to frustration. So she wants to have some control. She wants to do certain things, and she's not allowed to do those things. So I look at when it's happening, or is this, you know, is it a dog when the arousal biting is primarily happening when you're putting them back to the kennel? That's another really common. So I look at context of when it's happening, and starting a program with focusing on the basics in terms of making sure that we're doing everything we can in terms of making sure that she's having regular human interaction and making sure that she's having different types of human interaction. We know that shelter dogs, one of the things that they really struggle with is not having enough time to sleep or rest. And I found that when everything that we're doing with the dogs and taking them out is excitable stuff, active stuff, training, dogs forget how to settle. And so focusing on, which can be really challenging with what this kind of dog, but focusing on exercises where we can get them to settle a little bit, might be taking them in a room and giving them a Kong toy to chew on, or snuffle bat stations, which I know I saw you talk about in a presentation that I watched recently. Things that encourage them to engage a different part of their brain. We know that in people, rhythmic or repetitive activities can help us to regulate our emotions. So with this type of dog, I really do try to do a lot of those types of things, whether it's being in a room with them, allowing them to chew on a bone, sniffing that snuffle mat, these repetitive type of activities. We don't have research in dogs that show that it's helpful, but it's something that I'm I would love to do the research on this and find a way to do some research, because I'm very suspicious that it's something that helps dogs to emotionally regulate.
When you're ready to do that research, let me know. I'll be a willing participant in that study.
Oh, awesome. We'll definitely have to talk more about that. So helping the dog to learn how to settle by having times where they can settle, also working through impulse control exercises. So exercises, I like to do it with tug toys, teaching them that they don't take the toy until I allow them to take it and to learn to let go. And then the toy is given back to them as a reward for doing what I want them to do. So those types of exercises, once dogs have been experiencing this type of behavior for quite a while, in my experience, behavior medication is really quite necessary to be able to help them. So I frequently use behavior medication. There was a presentation at the Veterinary Behavior Symposium last summer that did some work using the combination of fluoxetine and clonidine for dogs with hyperarousal. And that's something that I've been using more and more in the shelter environment lately. And I'd say the big thing that I really try to do with these dogs is get them out of the shelter, whether it is starting with just getting them on field trips where they can get out for a couple hours, or sleepovers where they can get out for a day or more, ideally long-term foster. Oftentimes we struggle with getting these dogs out, though, because their behavior is intense enough that we're worried whether it's safe to place them in a regular foster home. And that's also why I really like developing relationships with local behavior people and trainers, so that we can initially have a place where we're paying someone who's knowledgeable and experienced to take that dog for a couple of days. And if that dog does well, hopefully, and in most cases they do, then they can step down to someone with less experience.
Those are great tips. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so let's talk about some of the most exciting programs that are being offered by Maddie's Fund to help shelter behavior staff. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the stuff that Maddie's Fund is offering now?
Yeah. What I'm most excited about is Camp Maddie Behavior, and you're going to be one of our speakers at Camp Maddie Behavior. Camp Maddie Behavior is a 2 half-day conference on March 20th and April 3rd. After these dates, all the presentations will be available on demand, so the recordings will be viewable. It's all free. But these 2 half-days are focused. So we did a survey with the animal shelter community to find out where they were struggling the most and what they were most interested in hearing about. By far and away, number one was finding homes for what was considered behavior dogs. And when we dove deeper into that topic, because my question is, well, does that mean it's all about marketing and getting them out the door? There was definitely broad interest in the topic, starting from things like risk assessment. Is this dog safe to place in a home? How do we decide whether this dog is safe to place in a home? When we do decide that a dog might not be safe to place in a home, how do we communicate with the people in our shelter and our communities about this, when historically we haven't had to make euthanasia decisions very often? Alternatively, when they are safe to place, how do we get them out the door? How do we keep them happy and healthy? How do we work to build and grow the resilience that these dogs have? And so that's what the focus of these 2 half-days are going to be, is all of these topics, with some longer presentations and then some short videos from different shelters in the country who have some great programs to help the dogs that we're trying to help. So super excited about those 2 days that are coming soon.
Yeah, and I'd like to stress again that the program is free for people to sign up and register. So even if they miss it, let's say they didn't know about it and they hear this podcast after the fact, can they still register and get the on-demand recordings?
Yes. So everything will be available after the conferences at maddiesuniversity.com. So you just go to the Maddie's University website, and if you search for Camp Maddie Behavior, all the presentations will pull up and you can watch them all for free on demand.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And I will be sure to post those links up on the show notes so that we can share it for everyone. And yeah, I have to say it's an honor and a privilege to be speaking along with the speakers that you have presenting. It's a pretty impressive lineup. So really, it's an honor to be part of this. I can't wait. I'm really, really excited for it. Is there anything else that you would like to share, either from Maddie's Fund or maybe something that you're doing that you want to share with our audience?
Probably. I mentioned it briefly already, I believe, but that is Maddie's Monthly Behavior Meetings. And so this is a meeting that is on the fourth Thursday of every month at noon Pacific time that Maddie's Fund hosts, where it's a meeting for behavior people who are working in shelters, behavior professionals who work with dogs who have come from shelters. It's really for anybody interested in behavior, where we have speakers come in and talk about different behavior topics that are relevant to us. So that's something that used to be hosted by Human Animal Support Services, a wonderful organization that is working to support people and animals in our communities. Hosting has just recently transferred over to us at Maddie's Fund. So I really encourage people to join and sign up for that. And just like the Camp Maddie Behavior, if you can't attend a meeting at the meeting time, the recordings are all available after the meeting.
Awesome. That link will go up as well, and we're going to share that all. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
So easiest way to find me is really just via email. Always happy to hear from people and to talk. My email is Sheila, S-H-E-I-L-A, at maddiesfund.org. If you go to our website and search me up on our website, you can get more information about me too. But email is always the easiest way to reach me.
Great. Thank you for your time. This is a wonderful talk. And I can't wait for the Camp Maddie event. I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun. And I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of new people.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Freddie. It's really nice to be here.
Thank you. Hey, animal lovers. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard and like to learn more, please follow us on Facebook or visit www.behaviorvet.com. We have much more cool stuff for you if you'd like to keep geeking out on companion animal behavior with the Behavior Vets team. Come back soon and join us on our journey to make life better for the animals in your life. Thanks again for listening. Remember to have hope, because real change is possible and we can achieve it together. Enjoy our podcast, but this is a reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. The comments and advice are never intended to be a substitute for seeing a behavior professional or a credentialed veterinarian in person. While the content is always intended to help people receive the best possible behavior support for their pets, any information you utilize from this podcast is at your own risk.